The new album from Don McLean, which is due out on March 23rd, Botanical Gardens, gave us the opportunity to speak to Don McLean, a legendary singer-songwriter, about not just Botanical Gardens, but also his career in bluegrass and the many recordings that he's made in bluegrass, the fact that he plays a banjo, he has an absolute love of banjos and banjo players. He will exhibit more of that in the second part of our visit with legendary singer-songwriter Don McLean. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. We're talking to Don McLean about Botanical Gardens, but as a matter of fact, as I look down here, Rock and Roll You Baby, Ain't She a Honey, those are very, as we talk about all these Total Eclipse of the Sun and these incredibly sad You All Ever Had as far as the tone, Rock and Roll Your Baby and Ain't She a Honey, those are not sad songs.
No, Rock and Roll Your Baby is I love that song. I love that. I think with an edit, that's a hit song. I don't know why. I just love that thing. And Ain't She a Honey the same way. That's one of the, for me, listening to it, that's one of the magic tracks on that record. Ain't She a Honey. You know,
it's very clever. Yeah.
Oh, and Dip Vipperman is playing this. He's a real good southern, you know, slide guitar player, and they're my boys that I take on the road. And so that's my band that I take everywhere.
Okay.
And there's five guys, and they are supremely talented as a group and individually.
Well, and I don't mean to give those songs short shrift, but I mean I wanted to let people know that there are, in addition to Lucky Guy, there are other happy, kind of upbeat rock kind of a tune. Yeah, so I mean you mix it up well, Don. I love the collection of songs on this album. That's why
Thank you.
Yeah, that's why I ask about when they came about, and I understand the answer to that.
Yeah, ask me anything you want.
Yeah, I've cried all the tears that I have. That I put, that's right in between. On do you work, by the way, on the lineup of songs on a release?
On what?
Do you put effort into, is it your decision as to how the songs are lined up? We have Botanical Gardens.
Oh, yeah, I do everything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I do the how they're programmed and how they're mixed and what's on what and what's on where. I'm open to all sorts of suggestions from everybody, of course. And like if I have strings, Tony will do the strings and I let people run, you know, do what they want to do, you know, and work with them, you know. They're all artists.
Yeah.
You know, tell people what to play, you know. A lot of people in music say you have to play every note this way. That's not how I do things. There's a certain jazz aspect to what I do.
Nice.
That's easygoing, but it's within us. Basically, I tell my guys, look, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I will tell you what I don't love.
Okay.
If I say, please don't do that, that's the only thing I'm going to say to you. The rest of it, you're going to be tasteful, you're going to do wonderful things, you know. And that's, you know, pretty much how it works. If I hear a guy play the same thing over and over again, that's not a good thing.
No, it isn't.
You know, I'm going to tell him, I'm not going to tell him anything, because obviously if he could do something else, he would, so there's really no point in telling him anything. He's probably not the right guy for me.
That's right. You're right.
So,
I got you off on the organization of the songs, and then you were talking a little bit.
Yeah. But I just want to make sure that you understand I'm not some kind of control.
Oh, no.
But I know how they should be programmed, and and I tried a bunch of different ways of doing it. And actually, I think Mike may have done something. And I liked what he did. So I think Mike was involved in the programming. I liked how he did it. I think I had it a certain way. He did it differently. I liked his way better.
Okay.
And what I also like about that record is the way the piano sounds.
Mm-hmm.
In the studio we were in Nashville, it's called Watershed. For some reason, the piano in that place, and Tony Migliori is just a virtuoso. I mean, and you got a chance to really hear it on some of the tunes.
You do. In between, Don, in between Rock and Roll Your Baby and Ain't She a Honey, which you've already described, you have sandwiched in between that and on the other side of Ain't She a Honey is I've Cried All the Tears That I Have, and then The King of Fools.
The King of Fools I like a lot. I was proud of that one. It kind of had Elvis Presley a little bit in mind as I think about about him. And he probably thinks that of himself, you know, because he was pretty self-deprecating. But there's a lot of us, you know, who, you know, you fly kind of high and then you may come way down. And I like that song. I don't know if I'm going to write another album that has as many good songs on this as this one. I think this may be a good thing from me. The next album I've got in the can is an album of a variety of other kinds of songs that are they're kick ass, because this band can do it, and they're great tunes, and there's a variety of them too. But
I think Don, you should go back and lay over just a real slight non-affrontive banjo track on one of those.
One of those, I don't know if there's a banjo track.
I'm just saying, give it a thought. Just saying, give it a thought.
Is there one somewhere?
I don't know. I'm talking about your new album. I haven't heard it.
Oh, on the new?
Yeah, I don't even know what you're talking about, but on one of those, find a place to put a little subtle banjo track in there.
Oh, geez. You know, that's not a bad idea. well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do.
Okay.
I have a project in mind already. I own... And I know this isn't going to mean anything to bluegrass people, but in the folk world back in the 50s, the long neck banjo was made by Vega.
Vega. Mm-hmm. That's who made Pete Seeger's, yeah.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And the first Vega banjo ever made by the factory was made on order for a great musician named Eric Darling.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Darling first formed a group called the Terriers.
I remember.
They had a hit record with the Banana Boat song in 1956. And then Eric became the replacement for Pete Seeger in the Weavers, and he was there for about 4.5 years. And he used that banjo throughout the time he was with them. Then he formed the Rooftop Singers and had a number one right in.
Yep.
And then he quit music. Around 1968, he kind of stopped playing music for some reason. I don't know why. Anyway, I have that banjo.
Nice.
And it is the first banjo, long neck banjo, that Vega ever made. And it is the most amazing sounding instrument. What I want to do is take that banjo and do an album of things with me, just guitar and banjo, where I do a lot of the frailing things that I got from people like, you know, Wade Ward and Roscoe Holcomb and these things like Peach Bottom Creek and, you know, these little things that I know hundreds of these songs, you know. Occasionally I'll put a link on a record with a frailing bit or something.
Okay.
Or a double thumbing thing or whatever, Devil's Dream or one of these things. And also the guitar, sing some just songs, my own, whatever, other people's solo. But use that banjo and put a whole collection of these type banjo things on a CD. So I'm already thinking about
that. That would be good. I would love to hear that one. Listen, I got to ask you a question. Why on the long neck banjos did everybody cable in the third? Why make them long? What was the
Well, the idea was to be able to play in G tuning. You put the whole thing all the way down, and it would be actually a key of E.
Okay.
So you could get a low sounding. It gave it a much more dynamic in terms of accompanying the voice than just a regular length banjo.
Okay. That's an easy answer.
Yeah, in a key open tuning, you had an E with those extra 3 frets. And you also, the strings are looser, and it's actually quite a good idea.
It's not quite so sharp. It's not quite so sharp sounding. And I don't mean note wise. I mean it's not so crisp. It's just a little more.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, those good banjo pickers, man. They have that. That's again, that's that Scruggs style. You had a whole variety, a lot more. Room to accompany the human voice as, you know, when you're singing these songs,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or But anyway, what I'd like to say is tell you a few things about Mike Kropp.
Yes, you can. We mentioned him off the air that I became friends with him, and you knew him, and you're going to tell us about that.
Well, Mike Kropp, I want to give you a little background about Mike Kropp. I'll tell you a little bit about how we met and everything. Because I loved Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Mike was a really fantastic person and a great musician. He was born his father was named Robert Kropp, Bob Kropp. And Bob Kropp was a very successful businessman. He was wealthy. And he had a business that provided beautiful high-end cabinetry for stereos, things like that, Fisher-type things, you know, stereos. He lived in a gorgeous, very big house in Mount Vernon. He and his brother, he had a brother. The brother went into the business. The father wanted Mike to go into the same business because they were very good at it. They were very successful. Father had a cigar-smoking, cool guy with a big Cadillac. And the house was just the most luxurious place. Mike had this huge bedroom. He could put my whole house in it. And he always had neat things around, magazines, you know, folk magazines and folk records and stuff that nobody else had, and, you know, instruments. And he was madly in love with all this stuff, to the complete exclusion of wanting to be involved with his father's business.
Oh.
and to the exclusion of school.
Oh.
You know, only wanted to play the banjo. And he just was mad about it. And he was so good at it.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was playing also, and I went to Iona Prep, which is a Catholic boys' school in New Rochelle. And Mike went to Horace Mann, which was a very good prep school. And I had a friend who had been with me in grammar school, and we played a little music together. And he did not stay in the New Rochelle school system. He went over to Horace Mann, and he said, "Don, you know, there's a kid you should really meet. I mean, this guy is, you should know each other." So he invited Mike over to his house, and I met Mike, and we started to play guitars and banjos, and he invited me to his house and all this stuff. And we had little groups together. In fact, the first professional job I ever had was with Mike Kropp, me, and another kid named Kenny Sherber, who sang really beautifully and played guitar and so on. And we formed a little trio, and we worked. We had a job at an Israeli coffee house in New York City, about 1962, around there. And I want to tell you, Mike drove, and he knew everything. This was 1962. I did not drive. I could not get a driver's license. I kept failing my tests. I was totally distracted all the time. I didn't drive until I was like 19. And everybody had to drive me everywhere. So Mike would say, "I'll come over and get you, and let's go into Greenwich Village." So Mike takes us, a few of us, and we go into Greenwich Village, and he goes to this folklore center with Israel Young. It's 1962. Mm-hmm. Dylan just getting started.
Yeah, sure. That was the height of it.
Mike showed me all this stuff. I saw the kids singing in the square there, Washington Square.
Yeah, that was the hot spot.
I saw this all. It was all happening. Mike introduced me to this. Then he went and got tickets for this, another time, for this Carnegie Hall show with, had Dylan on it. He made his first New York appearance, and a lot of other artists, folk artists and so on. It was the Hootenanny at Carnegie Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Tradition from the 50s. Mike did that for me.
Oh, nice.
Mike did a lot of nice things for me, and his parents liked me a lot. So, you know, I have a lot of affection for him, and he, later on, you know, I think he worked for Gibson, and he had a couple of different groups, and he was just an awesome player. But I made a couple of records in Nashville, and I had him come in, and he recorded a bunch of sides. I think I did a couple of things on a children's record, another couple of things on a record, some Western songs he was on, did a Western album, which I always love Western music, cowboy music, and he was on that record. And then I did a Marty Robbins album.
Oh.
He played on a couple of those songs as well. And that was pretty much the last time I saw him. And then I heard that he passed away, and I was really sad to hear it.
Yeah, I got to know him the last couple of years before that. And I will tell you this, I think this is an interesting point. As much as you have Eric Darling's banjo, Mike's favorite banjo, after he passed, it wound up going to a young banjo player up around the New York area named Gabe Hirschfield. So the banjos live on. You can't kill them. You can't get rid of them. They're still out there.
I love that banjo that he had. He was in love with banjos. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, he loved long neck banjos. He loved Vegas. He loved Gibsons. He loved, you know, all these different headstocks, and he knew the inlays. He introduced me to so many other people that were around in those days. He introduced me to the guy who ended up being the guitar player with Eric Weisberg on Deliverance. I can't think of that. Steve Mandel.
Yeah, that's right. I can see the album cover, and then, yeah.
Steve Mandel turned me on to a guy named Winnie Winston, and it was another aficionado of bluegrass music, and turned me on to Roger Sprung.
Roger Sprung, man, there's a name.
Yeah, and also there was a guy in New York. I can't remember this guy's name, but he was a night watchman, and he was a legend. This guy, his apartment was filled with like D-45 Martins and, you know, herringbone Martins and all these gold master tones, you know. I mean, he was one of the first serious Martin and Gibson collectors. And I don't remember. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I know.
And that guy was like, had the holy grails of these instruments. And, you know, in my whole life, I mean, I'm still collecting Martin guitars. I just got, you know, a 53 D28, and I just got back out of the shop. You know, I'm so into this. It's such a sickness. It's unbelievable.
It is a sickness. It is a sickness. I never tell my wife how many banjos I have in the house. I keep some of them where she can't find them. And if I count them up, I'm a little afraid myself, but I don't mention, I don't even think of them. Yeah, go ahead.
You need to have them to save them from somebody.
That's right. I paraphrase a term, and I won't say what it has to do with, but the phrase goes like this. I have more banjos than I need, but I don't have as many banjos as I want. And that comes from another political statement that doesn't, you know what I mean?
Well, it's like a dog rescue thing. You know, you're rescuing this, your queen's instrument.
That's what you have to look at.
Getting it a good home. I mean, you got to maintain these things.
You have to.
Really enjoy talking with you.
Thank you, Don. This is a beautiful album, Botanical Gardens. We covered most of it. It ends with The Last Night When We Were Young, which I think, again, finishes the story of this journey that the album takes from beginning to end. And they're all beautiful songs. Don McLean, I'm so thrilled. Thank you. To have the opportunity to speak with you about this music, and thanks for taking that journey back into the 60s with me.
I love your interview, and I'm glad you gave me a moment to talk about my family, because he was very important to me.
Yeah.
He opened my eyes to, I was just a dumb suburban kid with no money, and he shared his knowledge, his car.
His driving skills, which you didn't have.
And brought me to places that, you know, changed my life.
Well,
and I loved him very much.
That's a great story. I'm going to, Don, I've taken a lot of your time. I'm talking to Don McLean here on Unreal Bluegrass. Brand new album, Botanical Gardens, on BMG coming out March 23rd, I think is when the rest of the human beings, I have it because they let me listen to it, and I enjoyed it so much. Enjoy your music, and what a treat it's been. What a treat it's been. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Don. I'll talk to you sometime down the road. All right, bye. I want to thank, of course, Don McLean for his time. Believe me, this was not to be a 50-minute segment. That's why I cut it in two pieces. But Don really loved talking about the brand-new album and his days in bluegrass. And Mike Kropp, as you heard, that was him. I want to talk about Mike Kropp and all the stuff we did in the 60s. And it was a wonderful moment, and we went with it. Thanks so much for the people that publicized Don McLean, who asked me to talk to Don about the new album. Thanks more so, though, friends. You're nothing without friends. My good friends Mark Horowitz, a banjo legend in New York, and my good friend Michael Jonathan of Woodsong's Old Time Radio Hour provided me the background and the places to look for all that neat information that just allowed Don McLean to go back and relive and talk about his bluegrass and banjo days and all the love that he had for those times, and especially Mike Kropp. Thanks so much, Don McLean.